ICMA University is pleased to present this online program entitled The Role of EMS in Local COVID-19 Responses. We are very pleased to welcome all of you to this presentation. I would like to draw everyone's attention to the links box located on the left of your screen. This area contains links to handouts and resources related to today's program. When you click on a link, a separate web browser window or tab will open so that you can view, save, or print each item. The webinar evaluation link is also in this area. You must be logged into ICMA University to access the survey from here, but you can also find it on your dashboard after today's program by clicking on the program title. It is my pleasure to introduce today's presenters. Tom Wazorek is an expert in police, fire, and EMS operations and the director of the Center for Public Safety Management, ICMA's exclusive provider of public safety technical services. He has served as a police officer, fire chief, director of public safety, and city manager, and is the former executive director of the Center for Public Safety Excellence, formerly the Commission on Fire Accreditation International, Inc. Matt Zavatsky is the Chief Strategic Integration Officer at MedStar Mobile Healthcare, the regional governmental EMS authority for Fort Worth and 14 other member cities in North Texas, a service area of 436 square miles with more than 1 million residents without any public subsidy. Matt is also a senior associate with the Center for Public Safety Management, working with CPSM to provide recommendations to ICMA members to enhance and improve EMS delivery in their communities. Chip Decker is CEO of the Richmond Ambulance Authority in Virginia and the president of the Academy of International Mobile Healthcare Integration, an association of high-performance, high-value agencies serving a combined population of 7.6 million people, a geography of over 27,000 square miles, and responding to over 1.17 million ambulance calls. Dr. Veer Bithaloni is the intern medical director for the Office of the Medical Director of the Metropolitan Area EMS Authority, which provides medical direction and oversight to the MedStar Mobile Healthcare System. He is also an attending emergency physician and the EMS director for the JPS Health Network. He is both certified in both emergency and EMS medicine and is a fellow of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the National Association of EMS Physicians. Speakers, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. This is Tom Wazurek, and I'll be kind of starting things off today. I'd like to welcome everyone this afternoon to the webinar. Just a little bit about the Center for Public Safety Management. We've now completed about 348 projects in 44 states and Canada and 256 jurisdictions around the U.S. and Canada. We were created for and by ICMA members using approximately 50 years of research and development. One of our kind of highlights is strategically assisting agencies for the future, and also to develop staffing and workload analyses. One of the things that we've also been impacted the last few months is making the change from working office environments to more working from home and kind of staying safe. And so we've now relaunched and are working with a number of different communities around the country and kind of projecting ahead of what is going to be the staffing levels needed to handle the workload in the future. We've also made available for ICMA members a discount. There's a number of discounts that will be covered later for webinars and different things, but those are part of your ICMA membership and the value for the membership. And so if you need assistance in looking at staffing or your EMS or fire, police, dispatch systems, you can give us a call. That is one of the things that is the value and the resources that ICMA brings. But I'm going to be launching the webinar, and then I'll be coming back in, but I'll be turning it over to our experts on really the state of EMS, which is changing almost by the day. And so I will turn it over, and we'll go from there.
Thanks, Tom. This is Chip Decker. I'm the president of AIM High. A little bit about AIM High. The Academy of International Mobile Healthcare Integration represents high-performance emergency medical and mobile healthcare providers in the U.S. and Canada. MedStar Mobile Health is one of our members. And our member organizations employ the best business practices from both the public and the private sector. And glad to be able to present to you folks today. All right, so let's move right along.
Yes, thanks, Chip. So, Sudhir Vithalani. So, you know, I think everyone on the call has been inundated over the past few weeks with information about COVID-19, so I'll try and keep it brief. But just to give you a little bit of understanding about the disease process and really the virus itself. So COVID-19 was a disease that was first identified in China. There were a number of cases identified at local hospitals of a relatively significant impact on patients from a condition they hadn't quite seen a lot of. They were doing sort of viral testing and realized that they had a new strain of a coronavirus. So coronavirus itself is actually a family of viruses. There are four normal human coronaviruses, and these are what cause your normal, winter sniffles and cough, cold, especially in kids. And then there are three what we call novel coronaviruses, so SARS and MERS, which we've heard of in the past, and then now SARS-CoV-2 or SARS coronavirus 2, which is the actual virus that causes coronavirus disease of 2019, which is shortened to COVID-19. As we're all well aware, this is spread worldwide now. It's considered or classified as a pandemic by the World Health Organization, mostly due to the significant amount of person-to-person transmission. When we talk about the disease itself and what its impact is on our healthcare system, a majority of patients, or roughly 80% or so, are considered mild to moderate symptoms. And what that really means is you feel like you do when you have a bad flu, true influenza, so body aches, cough, cold, shortness of breath, fever, etc. And it's not necessarily a nice feeling to have, but we classify it as mild because the remainder of the cases, 15% severe, meaning that you have some requirement of being admitted to the hospital, so things like a viral pneumonia or a high oxygen requirement, and then 5% needing intensive care, almost all of those meaning they need to be placed on a ventilator for artificial ventilation. One of the things that you'll hear a lot about when we talk about COVID-19, especially as we compare it to other viruses that we've dealt with in the past, is this concept of the R-naught, or the transmissibility. And this is a number that reflects how many new patients a single infected person can infect. And when left alone, the best estimate that we have right now of COVID-19 is about 2.4. So for every infected person, they'll infect 2.4 more individuals. Now the R-naught itself is something that can be adjusted based on the actions of the community, and that's something we can touch on later. But the other thing that's important about this is that the case fatality rate, the percentage of people who die from a known positive infection, right now is hovering around 2%, and this actually varies quite a bit between communities and amongst countries, but best estimate right now is somewhere in the 1 to 2% range, with the highest risk being those in the elderly, classified as over 60, as well as those with pre-existing conditions, specifically heart and lung disease, as well as diabetes.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Vithalani. Dr. Veer, as we affectionately refer to him. This is Matt, so you recognize my voice. Chip and I and Dr. Vithalani are going to walk through with you guys what the impact has been on EMS. There's been a lot of public discussion, media coverage on the impacts to EMS, everything from the workforce, personal protective equipment. But we want to really give you that ground-level truth about what it has meant for operations like Richmond, like MedStar, that operate in essentially urban areas with a pretty significant call volume, a lot of patient contacts, very interactive and very engaged medical control group. Dr. Vithalani was kind of teasing when we were getting onto the call that, you know, we probably have seen each other more when we're in quote-unquote quarantine to some extent than when not, because of the level of engagement and the level of activity from the clinical oversight, because a lot of this is a clinical issue and certainly a clinical issue for our field staff. So let's first talk about the impact on the workforce. And for Chip and I, being sort of in the operational side of the service delivery, and for many of you who are on this webinar who you either contract for the EMS service or your fire department provides it, or you have a third service county or city type of organization, one of the biggest impacts has been on the workforce. Our folks are very concerned, obviously, about the coronavirus. This is something that they're not used to necessarily wearing full protective equipment on virtually every response that they do in the community. Part of that fear is they get so much information. We're going to talk about that more in just a minute. But one of the things that we have done, and I know a number of agencies have done, is hosting weekly, in many cases here, three times a week, twice a day, so six times a week, we have a conference call between the service leadership, our CEO, medical directors on that call, or representatives from the Office of the Medical Director, to literally brief the workforce on what's currently happening locally, nationally, but more importantly, answer questions that folks may have. And that feedback, that dialogue, that communication is very, very important to help with rumor control, to help answer questions or field concerns from the folks that are working out in the field or in the dispatch center, whatever the case might be, to make sure that you're communicating well and keeping them engaged and having them feel connected and, quite frankly, very well cared for. In some cases, you've seen on the media and has occurred in a number of communities, these employees don't want to go home because they're going to respond to a certain number of calls during the course of their shift where they might have things that they don't want to carry home with them, and therefore they're sort of afraid to go home because they don't want to infect their families. Generally speaking, most EMS workers, field EMTs and paramedics, are on a relatively tight financial constraint, and it is very difficult for them to make alternate arrangements for places to stay that may be safe. So one of the things that you may have to address as this crisis and the pandemic continues is finding some safe places for people to stay if, in fact, they don't want to go home, or if for some reason they can't go home because maybe there's someone who is infected with COVID-19 that's living there and we want to keep them separate from that family arrangement so that they don't have to be quarantined. One of the national associations, the National Association of Emergency Medical Technicians, worked out a deal with Hilton International where all of the Hilton properties across the country have made free rooms and their properties available for first responders and frontline healthcare personnel for those folks that don't want to or can't go home. So that's one of the things that when you hear things from your workforce, you need to address and work out some of those arrangements locally in your community if you can. One of the questions that we hear often is screening, isolation, if they do have to be isolated for a period of time. All of that is very, very important. We're going to talk about some of those as we go. But Chip, for you in Richmond, what are some of the things that you've experienced with your workforce that you think would be important to share with the ICMA group on the webinar?
So taking it home is the big deal. A lot of my folks are taking care of their parents or elderly relatives. And so as Matt said, taking it home is a big deal. This isn't the first time we've been through an issue that required us to act differently. Those of us that have been doing this for a long time, remember when AIDS first came out, then it was the bird flu, and more recently it was the Ebola. But this is a lot different, and because the transmission appears to be so rampant with the COVID-19. And so, yes, they're worried about getting it, they're worried about spreading it, and they're worried about getting a paycheck. And as Matt was talking about putting folks up in the hotel, yes. We just had somebody who spent 2 weeks in a hotel because they might have been exposed, and they had two at-risk elderly folks at their house where they live. So, yeah, taking it home and not really knowing if you're sick or not, because a lot of these folks, you know, my folks don't have thermometers at home. And so, yeah, and we'll get to how we're trying to keep our workforce safe. But, and I think that I do have a good bit of the folks are looking towards EMS week. EMS week is when we historically have, you know, had gatherings, if you will, for our field folks, and that's coming up the week of May 18th. And so, you know, there's a lot of concern about EMS week because we're not having that, obviously, social gathering anymore. And so, but in order to create or maintain some sort of normalcy in the workforce, yes, we're working on alternatives. So, but yeah, everything Matt said is, you know, we're all going through it. All going through it.
And Dr. Vithalani, one of the things that people often have questions about is an exposure. So from an epidemiologic perspective and from your physician's perspective, can you walk the folks through what really an exposure is as it relates to the workforce? Because Chip mentioned it. When does someone potentially need to be isolated for a period of time? What does that look like? What is an exposure? And then based on that, what happens next?
Sure, Matt. So, you know, as this is a novel coronavirus, things have changed over time. And so I'll try and give a boiled down version of what we understand right now. So this coronavirus, like a lot of other coronaviruses, are transmitted primarily through droplets. And so what that means is when you cough or sneeze, respiratory liquid particles shoot out into the air, and then those are inhaled by another person. And so that's the sort of standard way of transmitting any viral infection, but especially this coronavirus. The second sort of concerning way is what we call fomites. So those droplets would then land on something like a doorknob or on the person's hand if they sneeze in their hand, for example, and then those fomites can be picked up by another person by touching a surface and then touching their face. And so they would end up touching a place where it could be absorbed. It's not really the face per se or the skin. It's mostly the nares, the eyes, and the mouth. And then the last one and the most concerning one is this question of aerosolization. So true airborne diseases, we consider, you know, things out in the air that can transfer down the road. That's not really what we're talking about. But there is some evidence in COVID-19 that some of the respiratory droplets, or what we call droplet nuclei, can actually hang around in the air for a number of hours. And so especially when we talk about healthcare environments, for example, or an ambulance as another example, if you have a patient who has been spewing droplets everywhere, that air has the potential of, holding on to some of those viral particles and potentially infecting someone else. What we don't know right now is how many particles it takes for you to get infected, or whether your normal human reaction or an immune system could take care of it. That's all sort of out there being researched right now. When it comes to quarantine and isolation, I think it's important to, I'm a words person, so quarantine is when you do not know you have an infection, but you have a risk. So if the health department calls you and says, hey, your neighbor that you were hanging out with 2 weeks ago is now positive for the coronavirus and you need to quarantine, that means that you need to stay in your house for up to 14 days or at minimum 14 days since your last contact with that person. And the purpose of quarantining is to make sure that we can watch you in case you get sick and also to prevent you from spreading it to other people. The person that you came into contact with will be told to isolate. When you isolate, it means you have symptoms, you have the disease, and you're being told to stay home until you're better. And so better has two definitions. One is you've been tested in serial testing, such as two tests that were both coming back negative, or the CDC has some guidelines for sort of waiting a specific period of time after your symptoms resolve. It's roughly 3 days after your symptoms have resolved, as long as it's been at least 7 days since your symptoms. So that's quarantine and isolation. Isolation, in theory, can last longer than 2 weeks and can last as short as, I guess, 10 days. But quarantining is a 14-day period because that's how long it takes for us to know that since your last contact, you have not developed symptoms. And the last piece that has really thrown this situation for a loop is that there's some good evidence out there that there is potential for what we call asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic transmission. And what that means is on day 11 of after your contact with a positive person, you may not develop symptoms, but you start shedding viral particles and you start shedding aerosols. And then on day 13, you end up having symptoms. Well, those are just examples, but the point being is that up to 1 to 2 days before you exhibit symptoms, you may actually be infectious. And so that's why we have a lot of these measures such as mass quarantining, is because even if you feel well and you feel healthy and you feel like your risk is low, you may not know that you are spreading this virus around. And in the same vein, you may not know the person that you come in contact with is not going to develop symptoms after.
So what would be an exposure? So we do these things when people have been exposed. So the folks on the webinar have EMTs, paramedics, firefighters, police officers. When is an exposure an exposure?
So the definition I would say is at this point sort of an educated best guess, and what we talk about is close contact. So close contact means within 6 feet of someone, and people have tried to put sort of a minimum time limit on it. I don't know that any of it is really perfectly science-based, but we talk about a 10 or 15 minute close contact with someone without wearing appropriate PPE. So if we're talking about healthcare specifically, there is some good tables that the CDC have put out in terms of what risk categorization you have of an exposure based on what PPE you're wearing as a healthcare provider, but also what PPE you're able to put on the patient, such as a surgical mask, as well as what sort of items were happening while you were in contact with them. So the risk goes up, for example, if you intubate someone as opposed to if you simply transport them to the hospital. When we talk about the public, it's again a best guess of close contact without appropriate PPE in terms of at least face coverings of both individuals.
Excellent. Thanks. And for those of you on the webinar, Dr. Bethelani has done a great job of educating all of us what an exposure means. It's been an evolving process. So just a couple of examples from MedStar, and then Chip will do the same for how we try and help keep our workforce safe. So we implemented a process here a few weeks ago that after we decided to essentially go on lockdown. So currently we went through a process where every position within the organization was evaluated based on the practicality and the ability for that position to work remotely. And that was a very specific two-way test, if you will. How practical is it for someone to work at home? And then how realistic, essentially, would it be for them to do that? So we'll give an example. Our comptroller, who essentially does a lot of our financial analysis, they can literally work off-site with minimal impact on the organization and in many cases with minimal impact on their productivity. So they were on the short list of working remotely if we needed to really shut down and not have people in our headquarters facility here. Similarly, field EMTs and paramedics, you can't work remotely. They need to be here. 911 call takers, dispatchers need to be here. So we implemented essentially phase one of getting everybody off-site and working remotely from home who were able to do that. That required some processes for secure access to servers and whatnot, but we did that. But simultaneous to that, we essentially closed our facility to the public and now require every person who comes into our facility, they can only come through one door, and when they come in that door, they have to go through a health screening. The health screening is enabled through a tablet that we have on two stands that literally they come in, they gel their hands to get their hands clean. Then they answer five questions on an electronic tablet after they've logged in. So they log in with their email address, their register, et cetera. Then those questions are answered. If they answer the questions appropriately and the background screening is fine, they have a temperature taken remotely, scanned forehead primarily. And if they pass that health screening, then they are issued a bracelet, and this was the first iteration that you see up on the screen, where they were handwritten, COVID screened with the date and the time, and those wristbands are color-coded by day. So Mondays have a specific color, Tuesdays have a specific color, and so on for all 7 days of the week, and they're given a surgical mask to wear. Every person on campus has to wear a surgical mask, clinical, non-clinical, working in logistics, working in the dispatch center. Everybody's wearing surgical masks to prevent what you heard Dr. Veer talk about with that droplet protection, if you will. Even the field EMTs and paramedics, when they're on the ambulance, they have to wear a mask, a surgical mask, all the time. They wear a much higher particulate mask, the N95 mask that you often hear about for certain cases, and we'll be walking through that with you in a second. But that is how we're screening every person when they come into work to make sure that they're healthy and that they're not at risk for spreading the virus to the rest of the workforce while they are here on campus. Chip, what are some of the things that you're doing at Richmond that might be different than that?
So different than that, whenever anybody comes to work, they're going to get their temperature taken. We're going to take your temperature and make sure that you don't have a fever. One of the things is that, yeah, a lot of these folks don't have thermometers, and so they don't know if they are sick. And they also need to work. They're worried that they won't get paid. And so sometimes we have to help them make the best choice when it comes to working or not. I have about 300 employees between the field and the administrative side. And in the last few weeks, I guess we've been doing this just over 4 weeks now, is if you are sick, if you call out sick, or if we think you have been exposed to a patient, then we start monitoring you. And so of the 300 over the last 6 weeks or so, we've monitored 76 of my folks. Of that 76, 16 have been tested. Now the 76 includes, my allergies are flaring up, or they may just have a regular cold. But anybody who's calling out for sick is in the tracking category. Right now we're tracking 14 people. And we are awaiting 5 test results, and 2 have returned to work. 2 ended up in the hospital, and so my risk and safety guy has been doing a wonderful job making sure that everybody is accounted for, everybody gets spoken to every day that's out, And we're telling them when they can come back to work, and we're testing them when they walk back in the door. So that's just some of the things we're doing to try and keep the workforce healthy. Because what I've found is that my exposures are not coming from patients. When they're at work, they're pretty good about wearing their PPE, doing the right thing. It's when they go home, because my paramedics and my EMTs hang out with other healthcare workers. And so everybody has an enhanced, potential to be exposed. And so that's where the majority of the folks who have tested positive, and we are tracking for the potential COVID infection, is they're getting it from out in the community.
Awesome. Dr. Bethelani, let's talk about the dispatch process. Most of the AIM High members and a lot of EMS systems across the country use a formal EMS call-taking process that classifies calls in a certain way and assigns priorities. That is the Medical Priority Dispatch System. And that system actually has some capabilities to alter, based on medical director instructions, how those calls are taken, how they're screened. Do you want to walk us through the process that a lot of these places are doing now and what CARD 36 means?
Yeah, sure. So within MPDS, on the CARD, there's a CARD 36, which is really your pandemic or surveillance flu CARD. And it was really designed for pandemic flu, but given that the symptoms have so much overlap, we started using it for COVID-19, as did a lot of others. Essentially, CARD 36 works in a couple different ways. The first thing is, as a system, you have to decide that you want to utilize CARD 36, and that's generally when there's a pandemic that's out there. So what CARD 36 does is all calls that would have normally landed on CARD 6, which is breathing difficulties, CARD 10, which is chest pain, I believe CARD 30, which is headache, and as well as 26, which is, or I'm sorry, yeah, 26, which is sick person. Those four symptoms, instead of using their initial CARD, get first routed to CARD 36. And on CARD 36, it goes through the sort of standard key questions looking for a severe illness. And then it starts essentially a symptom-based question, and it asks them specific items of, do you have cough, fever, shortness of breath, runny nose, et cetera. And once you hit a certain threshold that's definable, it then dispatches based off CARD 36 as a presumptive pandemic patient, as opposed to if you don't meet the threshold, then goes back to your normal CARD, whether that's a chest pain, shortness of breath, et cetera. CARD 36 itself is really four cards, it works based off the suffix. So when you first turn it on, it operates in what's called surveillance mode, which is where the determinants result in the same dispatch priority and sort of response matrix levels that they would have if they had landed on CARD 6, 10, et cetera. And so the purpose of that is, as a pandemic ramps up, it starts to give you an understanding of how many cases you have out there and how severe they are. When you decide as a system that you need a little more configurability on your response planning for these types of patients, you can move up to level one and then subsequently levels two and three as needed. And this is where you can assign, again, like the standard priority dispatch process, you can assign different resources and different response priorities to the individual call levels or individual determinants. And so there are some, for example, that are young patients with chest pain who meet the symptom criteria, or older people with chest pain who meet the symptom criteria, or those who are considered high risk based off their historical features, and you can adjust your response accordingly. What we've been doing is working on two real things from the dispatch side, or one from the dispatch side and one from the field side. We have processes in development essentially to limit the amount of response to some of these lower acuity patients that might be calling with COVID-19-like symptoms. So, for example, if you land in the alpha category and you have chest pain and you're less than 35, or especially alpha 03, which is the flu symptoms only with no other high-risk features or symptoms, we can send that either through our nurse triage program or through some paramedics who are on light duty or themselves are high-risk and are stationed in the communication center, to go through an additional secondary triage or secondary call-taking, where we ask them again and get a better understanding of their symptoms, do a sort of telephonic or video medical evaluation, and then can either redispatch an ambulance or navigate them to a more appropriate place for evaluation or testing.
Great. Yep, so we're going through that process now. Now, from the response process, so Chip, in Richmond, have you guys changed how you respond to these types of calls based on the pandemic itself right now?
We have. One of the first steps that we did was reduce fire first response. And so we looked at some of those call types that, all right, one, does what is the potential for it to be a COVID patient. Two, what is the first responders, what are they really doing when they get there? And three, all right, does it just make sense to have them in reserve and not infect them? So, yes, wearing PPE all the time. We finally went to that. We got stung way too much with asymptomatic patients, and then 2 days later you get a phone call and say, oh, such and such, in the hospital now, tested. And then I lose a bunch of people out for, 14 days. But, and another thing is one person goes in, pretty much on every call now, because it has changed over time. It was a bit lax, if you will, as the information was coming out, but now it's fairly restrictive. People wait in the street, the responders waiting in the street, one person goes in. We've made arrangements with all of our nursing facilities, congregate care homes, that they will bring patients, when possible, to the front door, so we don't have to go inside. And so, yes, a bunch of changes on how we, that's changed how we do business. One of the PR things we should do was ride-alongs, whether it was news or students or whatnot, and so we're not able to do that anymore.
Yeah, great point. And in addition to the things that Chip mentioned, we're doing the same things here at MedStar. We also created a process that allows the first response units, if there are first response units going on a particular call, to come onto a common talk group on our radio system so that the responding ambulance and the responding first response unit will be able to talk to each other prior to arriving on scene to do some coordination about staging locations. We're going to meet in the front yard, or we're going to meet in this particular parking lot, and we're going to have that little huddle, almost like a little incident command system real quick, and decide which one person is going to go in. Now, that primarily is on the calls that don't have CPR in progress or things like that. Those calls are handled a little bit more traditionally. But that process that Chip talked about and that Dr. V talked about really helps minimize the potential exposure risk for personnel. But honestly and logistically, it also helps preserve PPE, because we'll talk about it in a little while. The PPE shortage has been a real bane of our existence to a large extent, and doing these types of processes helps, doesn't alleviate, but certainly helps with the burn rate for the PPE that you're using on scene. So that also does help. Chip mentioned not taking third riders. One of the things that many systems have done, primarily also in partnership with the hospital systems, is limiting even family members from accompanying the patient to the hospital in the ambulance. That certainly is a good clinical practice for infection control, but most of the hospitals have also limited the number of people that they're going to allow into the hospital with the patient, with some exceptions of, parents or, a specific caregiver, but certainly limiting the number of people that are going to be going in. So, In many cases, we're not even taking family members with us in the ambulance to the hospital. The other thing that has impacted this whole process is the decontamination procedures. So we sort of tease people here. It's probably never been a better time to be a patient in the ambulance, because the ambulances have never been cleaner than they are right now, because everybody is solely focused on keeping the back of those trucks clean. But that does add to the task time. So whereas normally we may have a 20, 30-minute time at destination, now that's going to be longer. It could be 40, 50 minutes, because that time deconning the back of the ambulance after each call is going to be a little bit longer. That impacts your operations. That impacts your ability to respond to other calls in many cases. So a lot of that has to be taken into account in your local community when you're talking about the EMS resources that are being available for your community in the field. Dr. V, what are some of the changes that you've made in clinical protocols for the field EMTs and paramedics here at MedStar?
Yeah, so we've had to adjust a number of clinical sort of instructions. So the first one and our first set of directives that came out were really about identifying patients that were potential for COVID-19. So as it started, it was those with travel, then it became travel or close contact, and now we're at a place where we essentially say anybody with signs and symptoms of a lower respiratory infection has to be treated as if they potentially have COVID-19 because of the amount of community spread that we have. And with that comes the PPE requirements, as everyone's mentioned. So wearing full airborne precaution PPE when evaluating these people and making sure that everyone is protected who is going near the patient, as well as limiting the amount of people who actually come in contact with them. The second thing was, as I mentioned earlier, one of the more concerning ways of transmitting this virus is to aerosolize it. So unfortunately, there are a few things that we do to benefit patients that creates aerosol droplets. And so one of the most simple ones that we started with was nebulizer treatment. So by definition, nebulizers, they're called nebulizers, but they're really aerosols. We are mixing respiratory droplets with the secretions of a patient and allowing it to fill the back of the ambulance or to fill their house. And that's simply carrying the virus with it everywhere we go. So we implemented a directive where we have a number of aerosol generating procedure minimization strategies. So using a patient's inhaler as opposed to nebulizers, using other medications that do the same thing as nebulizers, such as intramuscular epinephrine, IV magnesium, et cetera, if possible, trying to avoid that. And then, especially when it comes to our really sick patients, a lot of airway management techniques generate a significant amount of aerosol. So bag valve mask ventilation, any of the other advanced airway management techniques, endotracheal intubation, et cetera, especially due to the way in which you force air in and out, are likely to generate a number of aerosols. So we put out instruction where essentially if we're going to do any of these procedures, then you must be wearing full airborne precaution. The adage is that there's no emergency in a pandemic. If you get sick, you're not able to help the next person. And then we have recently implemented viral filters, which go between the patient's airway device and the bag valve in order to catch and sort of filter out those droplets as much as possible. And then the last thing that we did is something that a number of AMHI agencies probably have in some fashion, but probably not to this scale, at least not here, is we implemented a non-transport and referral process. So in working with our community healthcare partners, we identified that a majority of the concern about COVID-19 patients is getting tested, as well as in those patients who have really mild symptoms and don't need an emergency department, nor do they need an ambulance ride to the emergency department. So for those cases that we can't screen out through our communication center, we have a process in place now where if a crew arrives on scene, a single member goes in with full PPE and does an assessment, and their clinical suspicion is for that of a patient with COVID-19, they have no high-risk symptoms, no high-risk signs, and meet normal vital sign criteria, then they are handed a leaflet which gives them instructions about COVID-19 and what the next steps are in terms of home isolation, in terms of reaching out to our healthcare facilities that have set up drive-through or walk-up testing sites, and how to take care of themselves at home until they're getting better. And this is something that really we've done a lot of in the mobile integrated healthcare sphere, but we have not done a lot of in the traditional 911 environment. And we have a good number of these a day now, and we do 100% quality assurance review on all of them. And for the most part, we've had a good success keeping low-risk and low-symptom patients at home who were calling simply to go to the emergency department for testing, which is not an appropriate utilization of the ED.
Great. And Dr. Vitalani, while you're on the topic, there's been a lot of discussion, certainly in the media and some others, about this term crisis standards of care. And some discussions in the New York area, coming out of the New York area, about their modification of how they treat cardiac arrest victims in the field. Do you want to talk a little bit about what crisis standards of care really means and maybe some commentary, opinion, quote unquote, if you will, on the New York brouhaha?
So, So crisis standards of care, you know, if we look back at the whole concept of flattening the curve, right? So why do we have mass quarantine? Why do we have social distancing? It's because even if we have to have the same number of people infected over time to achieve our herd immunity, we want to do so in as slow a fashion as possible because we have a limited amount of healthcare resources. And so we talk about inpatient beds, we talk about ICU beds, and we talk about ventilators. Crisis standards of care are a thing that the healthcare community should at least identify ahead of time to determine on as fair a level as possible, which is not fair to begin with, which patients should be given the limited healthcare resources if a time were to come where the system was overwhelmed. And so especially in a time like this with a worldwide pandemic, a lot of our emergency management plans and a lot of our surge plans take into account, oh, well, we'll just get, you know, 100 more ventilators from, Dallas, or we'll drive them down from Oklahoma and we'll have these resources. But in a worldwide pandemic, that's not possible. And so there's a number of schools of thought on how you best implement a crisis standard of care. But generally speaking, it's something that's agreed to amongst healthcare leadership, governmental leadership, local politicians, health systems, et cetera. And as an example, what it does is it groups people objectively based on, for example, their SOFA score, or their sequential organ failure assessment score, and uses the most rare healthcare resources on patients who would have the most benefit from those resources. And so when we talk about a ventilator, if you have two patients, one with a very high SOFA score and already with a low chance of survival, and the other with a low SOFA score and a high chance of survival, what a crisis standard of care process would be is where those cases are submitted to an external body that know the criteria and hand back down to the medical team which patient to put on the ventilator. That's just a frank example of a crisis standard of care. Generally speaking, it also transcends the pandemic itself, because if you have a patient who is dying from a different disease that already has a very low likelihood of survival, the argument should be that they are also evaluated through the same processes, and it should be regardless of what's causing the need for these advanced procedures or advanced techniques. There was a little bit of media that came out of New York when, as you know, those of you who are in New York, it's a little more regulated in terms of EMS than we have here in Texas. So we're a delegated practice state in Texas. I believe it's called the REMAXIS, or the regional EMS system in New York. A decision was made amongst the hospitals and EMS leaders where the hospitals had essentially said, we're not going to continue resuscitation on anyone who doesn't have a return of spontaneous circulation. And so a directive went out in New York saying not to transport any cardiac arrests and to terminate them on scene. And, you know, those of us who have been doing this for a number of years already in our systems sort of took it as, New York catching up with the rest of us. But I think in reality, too, we have to remember that there are still patients that we do transport. So those in ventricular fibrillation, for example, and it is also an instruction not to transport those people because, for example, the reason to transport a VF patient is to get them to the cardiac cath lab, and most of the cardiac cath labs are actually shutting down due to concern of spreading COVID-19 in their cath labs. And so that's what happened in New York, and that's sort of a summary of crisis standards of care.
Excellent. Thank you. Chip, let's talk about response volume. So we've heard often about the hotspot locations like New York, Detroit, Chicago, but in sort of the tale of two communities, you've got these hotspots where the EMS system, the healthcare system is stretched to its possible max, and then you've got the rest of the country. So do you want to share with the folks, what are you seeing in Richmond with regard to your call volume and your transport volume, and then we'll share what we're seeing here at MedStar.
All right. Thanks, Matt. So in Richmond, we're seeing about a 22% drop in call volume and responses. And we've been looking into this to figure out, okay, what's the deal? Well, one is that people aren't coming into the capital city during the day to work because everything is closed. So obviously, car crashes are down. We looked at our loyal customers, if you will. The top 10% of our loyal customers are using us twice as much, but the rest of the folks that would normally call us routinely are not calling us. And so it looks like that folks who typically would call us, you know, are not. Now, a couple of things are up, and frighteningly, actually. Cardiac arrests are double what we would expect. And DOAs, people that we arrive and, dead on arrival, that's way up also. And so we're looking in to see, all right, are people scared to go to the hospital? You know, could that be, you know, what the case is? You know, could something be out in the field? But, yeah, for some reason, our cardiac arrests are up through the roof. And it seems to be across all age groups. And pretty much all different types of call types, whether it's the sick or the overdose, everything is just down across the board. And so that's giving us some challenges and will give us challenges in the future, obviously, because we get paid to transport at this point.
Yeah, we're going to cover the finances here in just a few minutes. And, we're seeing very much the same thing. And we hear from across the country that EMS systems, call volume is down, hospital systems, patient census is down. Now, part of that was deliberate because they wanted to preserve or in some cases enhance the hospital system capacity. But they've canceled elective procedures and all sorts of things. But when we surveyed sort of informally our field staff, they told us exactly what Chip said. Hey, a lot of people are staying home, which means that they're not crashing their cars, they're not going out drinking at night and falling or getting into fights, whatever. And the domestic violence bump hasn't happened yet with people staying home so often. But also, when the crews advise the family that they cannot ride with the patient to the hospital, a lot of families and patients are saying, you know what, then we're not going to go. So that's also been sort of an interesting thing. And then, as Dr. Vithalani mentioned, some of the patients, it's a small number, but some were encouraging not to go to the hospital if they have those low acuity, potentially COVID-related symptoms. So, again, much like Chip had mentioned, our response volume is down about 19%. Our transport rate is down, or the number of transports that we do is down about 31%. So that's great for the crews to a certain extent, but certainly has some impact on the finances that we'll talk about in a minute. And again, we are, much like Chip said, we are very concerned that people are not calling that should be. We recently just did a news story here locally with one of our TV partners encouraging people not to wait, not avoid calling 911 if you really think that you need to do that, because the last thing that we want to have happen is what Chip is beginning to see in his community. We're doing some of those metrics here to see if that's really happening. We've actually had a conference call with our local American Heart Association affiliate to talk about some joint messaging that we might want to do and partner with the hospitals to see what they're seeing, but they're even seeing their STEMI volumes going down. So this is just sort of a daily review, if you will, of our response volume since we started the CARD 36 process that Dr. Vithalani mentioned. So again, a fair number of the calls are classifying as CARD 36. That's on the right side of the line that you see on the screen. That's sort of leveled off over the last few days, but you can see that CARD 36, which again, in the past would have been a chest pain chief complaint or a difficulty breathing chief complaint or a headache chief complaint or general sick, are being reclassified. So it's not really increasing our call volume, it's just increasing the pandemic presumptive, based on dispatch information, possibility for those calls. So you can see that on average about 64 calls per day are screening as ones that the responders need to be very careful with when you arrive on the particular scene of that call. In the same light, we look at the patient care reports. And we have a whole process in place with our local emergency operations center, and Dr. Vithalani chairs a regional medical oversight group that is helping to coordinate some of the responses in the clinical care over the pandemic. But we have a process in place with our field crews that in their electronic patient care reporting system, they can identify patients that they have actually treated on scene and or transported, that they truly think this patient needs to be tested because they're symptomatic, they meet a lot of the history background, and history and physical indicate that they are at a very high risk for being a coronavirus patient. And you can see that about 31, 32 on average, on a typical day, are patients that the crews are saying in the field should have some type of a follow-up. And then you can see that, you know, a fair amount of them are transported, some are not. So we use that protocol that Dr. Bithalani mentioned on the leaving the coronavirus patients at home. But you can kind of see where that data is leading us. Let's talk briefly about EMS's role in the larger healthcare community. And Chip, we'll go back to Richmond for a minute, and we're going to get Dr. Bithalani to comment on this as well. But what are some things that you're doing different today than you were doing, say, 60 days ago with the integration with the rest of your healthcare system in Richmond?
Well, number one is I'm talking to them much more often at this point because they're changing a lot, because with along with our volume being down, hospitals, at least here so far, are not seeing the patient volume that they used to. And so they're shutting down services. And so what we're having to try and do is keep up, okay? This particular hospital has shut down their behavioral health service, or this has shut down their PICU, because as the hospitals are consolidating their people and their services, we have to make sure that we're not now dropping a sick baby into a hospital that hasn't, you know, that has temporarily or permanently shut down their pediatric services. All the hospitals seem to have set up tents that as checkpoints. You have to go through the tent checkpoint. Then the thunderstorms came. And so that happened to be a challenge, is that, all right, you're putting a tent in a parking lot, and this is the a bad time for storms. So they're working through that. One of the weather apps actually just came out yesterday and said that they'll give hospitals free subscriptions because they know that they need to stay abreast of the fact that storms are coming. But so, yes, hospital drop times are longer, as Matt mentioned earlier, so that makes our time on task longer, which means to run the same amount of calls, you would need the same unit, or you need more units because your call time is longer. What's saving us right now is that we are having to do fewer calls. And so everything sort of works out in the wash.
Yeah, interesting. One of the things that we'll add in addition to what Chip mentioned is that every hospital has a concern about surge. So in the event that they need to have more patients leave their facility, transfer them between hospitals in the same system, or transfer them to other facilities in the community to make room for the potential surge that they may be seeing, almost all of our hospital systems have said, okay, MedStar, what's your plan? If we need to move 30, 40, 50 patients from one hospital to another, or from one hospital to our ambulatory care center a city away, how often and how quickly can you do that so that we can increase our hospital capacity? Well, that may be fine when one hospital system wants to do it, we can probably manage it, but when you get two or three that all want to do the same thing, now you've got to make sure that you've got a good surge plan within your own EMS agency in your community, but that you've got potentially good mutual aid agreements or automatic aid agreements with other EMS agencies outside of your immediate jurisdiction to come in and help you with some of those potential transfers for the interfacility volume. Dr. Bithalani, from your perspective, and maybe explain a little bit about what the TMOC is and how clinically you're partnering with a lot of the hospitals and even some of the non-traditional healthcare providers that we might not normally deal with in our community, and how's that coordination working?
Yeah, so the TMOC stands for Tarrant Medical Operations Center, and the concept of a MOC or a Medical Operations Center transcends most of Texas, and I'm assuming outside. Essentially, it is a coordination function within the EOC for the way I've had to boil it down in my head is, you know, there's government and public safety, and then there's hospitals and health systems, and there's not really a link between the two, right? The local government doesn't entirely have a say in how hospitals operate, and vice versa. What the TMOC aims to do, or the MOCs aim to do, is be that bridge and that coordination function between the health systems, public safety, local government, as well as the public health department. So as an example, we have mostly city-based public safety agencies, but we have a county-based public health department, and we have a county-based hospital system, and then two private not-for-profits and a private for-profit hospital. And trying to get all those people to sit down at the same table and talk with a unified mission is occasionally difficult to do, but that's what the MOC has been very useful for, is when people see a unbranded document that simply says, you know, the Joint EOC and the Medical Operations Center has decided this process, there's a lot less turf and sort of territory grabbing about it. I mean, what it also allows us to do is when a larger hospital is willing to help out a smaller hospital, we're able to do that, especially if it crosses health systems. We're able to help sort of coordinate the needs of the hospital systems as well as public safety. So when we talk about, for example, standing up an alternative care site, if four hospital systems want to each stand up 20-bed ambulatory surgical centers as their overflow units, that's great, but that requires four separate groups of security and transport and documentation, et cetera. But if we could pool our resources into one big convention center, then it doesn't matter who you work for, they'll still pay you. You just come to work for this agnostic group on a more reasonable level. That's really what we've been able to do for this area that doesn't normally happen on a day-to-day basis.
Excellent. Thanks, Dr. Vitalani. There are a couple of things that EMS has been asked to step up and help do in the community. Now, at MedStar, we've been doing a community paramedic or mobile integrated healthcare program for many years, but really across the country, many EMS agencies are being asked to do things a little bit differently. So here, we were asked by our public health authority, Dr. Vitalani mentioned it, the Tarrant County Public Health, to help them do testing, swabbing, really not testing, but gathering the samples that they would need to test persons who are under investigation in their home, and instead of sending Tarrant County Public Health employees out to do that home visit, gather the sample that they need to do the testing, they asked us to do that. So we already had some community paramedics and Dr. Vitalani and the health department prepared a directive and some training programs, and those community paramedics are being used to go out into the homes, do that sample collection, return it to the health department for testing. Those are primarily first responders and healthcare workers that we've seen most of the time to try and get them cleared if they have a test that comes back negative or allowed to go back to work more quickly. That actually transitioned a week or two ago. In addition to doing the periodic home visits for the sample collection, the Tarrant County Public Health used to host a drive-up, we can't say drive-through, a drive-up testing process for some of the persons under investigation. They asked for some assistance doing that. We started assisting them at their facility, then finally said, hey, can you guys just do this at your headquarters? So today, every morning, every weekday morning, from 8 until 9, sometimes 10, sometimes noon if people are late, somebody drives up, and we have a kit that the public health department gives us every evening for the test the next day. The samples are collected, and at the end of that sample collection process, the samples are brought to the lab at Tarrant County Public Health to be able to test and see if we can get those folks screened and back out into the community. Also, we literally today just got a request from one of our other system partners to do follow-ups on COVID-positive patients who have been sent home, make sure that they're doing okay, to try and prevent them from having to come back to the hospital if their condition worsens, doing a lot of the social determinants of health and other things. So for you folks on the webinar, your local EMS system may be asked to do some of those things as well. So just give yourself the heads up. And here's an example of the folks that are here doing that drive-up testing each morning that we're doing here. Chip, how about in Richmond? Are you guys doing anything else, enhanced role that you might not have done in the past at the request of some of your local community stakeholders?
Well, that's why MedStar is like the leader when it comes to this this community effort. Early on, we were asked to participate in some of the drive-through testing. Our issue early on was that we just didn't have the PPE and were worried about the supply. And so, so other than checking on folks from time to time at the request of the hospital, we don't have as robust a community paramedic program as you do in Fort Worth. But the things I look at, yeah, are we trained to? Do I have the personnel to do it? Which I do have the capacity because I got folks that are, you know, looking for work, and do I have the PPE to do it?
Always a limiting factor. Chip, talk to us about the response to your community. This is an epidemic. This is a pandemic. I'm sorry. This is a crisis, if you will, that's different than in the past. And really the heroes are those frontline healthcare workers, the folks like Dr. Vithalani, the EMTs and paramedics out in the streets, other first responders. What are you seeing in your community as far as supporting your folks and the things that they're doing in the field? How's that been in Richmond?
Well, everybody's sitting at home trying to come up with, you know, ways to keep busy, ways to show their support. And the outpouring of support that we've had has been incredible. In City of Richmond, we have a lot of little breweries, little microbrews. And so, yeah, so they switched over. And so I was literally getting barrels of hand sanitizer in drums of, you know, 55 or 85 gallon drums. And so one of the things that the community came and rallied around us was to feed us, because yeah, the folks out there, they may not have as great access to some of the fast food as they used to. And so yeah, so we got, you know, my folks are actually well fed at this point. And so masks, N95 masks. Well, according to what the last numbers I heard, is that only about 30% of the N95 masks are used in healthcare. The rest of them, 70%, are used in manufacturing and construction. And so we have lots of people donating N95 masks. They may not have the gowns. You know, some have the paper masks, but I got a veterinarian dropping them off, some off today, but construction, that's where you can really get these things if you're starting to run out, because there's certain things that you can buy as a construction worker that will actually come with, or used to come with, N95 masks. So everybody who has a mask is giving it to us. And so, yeah, that's been great. And the news has been good, you know, towards first responders. They're interested in what we're doing. And it's, in a lot of cases, you know, my folks getting, you know, free pizzas, if you will, is the only good thing on the news spot for the half hour.
Exactly, because there are no crashes anymore. So, Chip, let's quickly talk about some of the current challenges. So we talked a lot about the workforce, a lot about the PPE challenges. There is a great tracker that was put together by the International Association of Fire Chiefs. This is updated literally hour by hour so that we can really track what the impact has been on exposures and isolations or quarantines. We're going to send that link to you guys so you can kind of keep an eye on it if your local EMS agency isn't doing that. So that really does help, but we got to constantly keep track of how our workforce is being impacted by these types of things. They're also tracking PPE need dashboard, so make sure that you're partnering with your first response agencies, and remember your law enforcement, because they need personal protective equipment as well, but there's a way to report that. Make sure you're working with some folks to make sure that you can keep that pipeline open. We're also suffering a little bit of information overload, and I'm going to let Dr. Vithalani talk what the number of conference calls and local, national, regional, and managing that extreme information overload at the same time that you're trying to manage things on a day-to-day basis. Dr. Vithalani, how many calls are you on a day, and how often are we now using video conferencing?
I'm on 3 calls right now. it is hard. There's a lot of information out there, and like all times with when large information starts flowing, there's a lot of bad information. There's a lot of opinions. You know, one thing that I keep in the back of my head is I'm going to boil myself down to a scientist, and I would think that every decent scientist will say that, you know, we're never going to know everything. Everything's an educated guess. There's some stuff we're not going to know, and we have to be okay with making important decisions off of minimal information, and really that is the definition of what emergency medicine and EMS does on a daily basis. And so if anything, this is exactly like what we do, just on a much larger scale. We have adapted a number of some of our processes to try and make them remote. You know, we do our medical director interviews, some of our quality assurance meetings. Most of my staff has gone home and is able to work remotely. But it's also, despite having a lot of physical distance, it has increased the amount of collaboration, not just in the local region, but, you know, the Eagles, for example, we have calls twice a week. Texas A&MSP has a call once a week. There's obviously the CDC and others have calls. And so there's a lot of information out there, and as much as possible, you just learn to filter out the good stuff and try and incorporate it as best you can.
Chip, let's talk about the economics. So we talked about the call volume reduction. We talked about the expense increases. Let's put some color around that. So at MedStar, we just did a briefing for the Fort Worth city manager and one of the council members, who also is our public board chair, that our costs have increased by about $1 million, and our revenue, because of the low transport rate, between now and September is expected to decrease about $6 million. So overall, it's a $7 million net loss over the course of the next few months. And that's going to be a significant issue. Have you done a similar analysis in Richmond, and how does that look?
We have, and I'm just very glad I'm a much smaller operation than you are, because, those are some big numbers. Well, the city itself is having challenges with the budget. We don't operate without a subsidy, you know, and so I rely on city funding also. And that's kind of up in the air at this point. But yes, the downturn in the volume is going to probably show up in the next 50 days. That's kind of like our billing cycle, if you will. And healthcare billing, it can be challenging on a good day. And so, yes, we're expecting, you know, similar to Matt, we're going to make less money. I got too many trucks on the street for the call volume that I have, except at 3:30 in the afternoon. I don't know what's going on at 3:30 in the afternoon. I don't know who's speaking, but they need to stop because my call volume goes to something unmanageable at 3:30 every day. And so, check back in about 2 months and our cash flow is probably going to be impacted.
Yeah. And for the folks that are on the webinar, one of the things that's happened is that several of the national associations have been working really hard to get short-term financial relief. Last Friday, Medicare made a disbursement of stimulus money, and we noticed it right away. We do our own billing. We do our own collections. We knew, because there was actually very little notice that this was going to happen, but sort of suddenly on Friday morning, we got a $670,000 payment from HHS that was labeled stimulus dollars, and it came to our Dropbox automatic deposit. All healthcare systems who bill Medicare got something from the government. So if your fire department or your third service agency is providing the ambulance service, check your general revenue funds or wherever the billing revenue comes to for the ambulance services that are provided in your community. Make sure that you received that augmented stimulus payment. That money, as with most federal money, does not come without strings. So there are some strings attached to that, and there's an 11-page document that your primary financial person listed with CMS would have gotten by email that you have to review. And if you agree to comply with those regulations, then you're free to use that money. One of the big regulations, or one of the big strings, is that you cannot balance bill patients who are confirmed positive with the coronavirus. So you have to make sure you've got systems in place that in your billing agency, or if you're doing the billing yourselves, that you're not billing those patients a balance after their insurance paid for that. So make sure you're checking some of those things. But we were on a call yesterday with one of the large national fire associations, and the president of that association was unaware that that deposit had been made. So we just want to make sure that you guys are aware of it. All right, so for the few minutes that we have left before we do Q&A, let's talk a little bit about some of the best practices. So Chip, what are some things that you might want to advise the ICMA members that are on this webinar that they should continue to do or start doing as we weather the rest of this pandemic?
Well, one of the challenges is buying stuff, procurement, whether it's PPE. You know, I am not going to pay $9 per N95 mask. I say that today. But so, and watch out for deals that are too good to be true, because they still are too good to be true. So don't turn off your intelligence. Check out the suppliers. Check out, you know, the folks that you're purchasing from. And I get this. What happened was a bunch of localities got together, decided that they were going to, you know, buy this great big thing, this whole big mess of 90 N95s and gowns. And they put all their eggs in one basket, and it fell through. Now they don't have PPE. Another group was trying to get together with a vendor to charter a plane to go to China, pick up some masks and stuff, and bring it back. Okay, then there's this thing called customs, all right, and that ended that. But and so make sure that your other, you know, local departments are doing their due diligence when it comes to making these purchases. So that is, you know, the big takeaway when it comes to that. Your EMS folks, your fire folks, your public safety folks, they're used to dealing with things that are not necessarily going their way, and so they're typically able to react. We call it more agile. You know, we can shrink and swell, and so you know, use those folks.
Dr. Bithalani, how about you? One best practice you'd like to share with the audience?
Oh boy, best practice is you know, communicate with absolutely everybody. You know, especially as the sort of medical figure. You know, my job doesn't entail public health within its description, but it seems like that's a whole lot of what we're doing. And much like EMS, sort of fitting in places where there are gaps. As medical directors, I think we end up doing a lot of the same. So work with your EMS organization, but work with your hospital systems, work with your local government, work with whoever you need to make sure that we can get through all this.
Okay. And I would just add, make sure your medical director is plugged in. Dr. Vithalani has done an incredible job becoming the voice of, I would say, reason in city council meetings and the media, and having that engaged medical director is phenomenally important, and make sure that you choose correctly when you're going to have when it comes time to have a medical director, so you can have one like Dr. Vithalani or like Dr. Renato. So, Darianne, let's turn this over for the Q&A. I know we've gotten a few that have come in. Do you want to address those, and we'll try and answer them for us for the audience?
Sure. Yes, absolutely. At this time, we will open it up. If you do want to submit a question, please type it into the chat box at the lower left of your screen, and then be sure to click that send button so that we receive it. First question for the speakers. Without widespread testing, when we have an EMT with possible exposure, we need to quarantine them for 14 days. When and how can we get first responder testing instantly or near instantly?
I'll take that, Matt, if you're all right.
Yeah,
So I think that it's important to remember that the test itself, one, does not really work if the person you're testing does not have symptoms. So if I were to go out and hang out with a known COVID-positive person, tomorrow I could get tested and show negative. 8 days from now I could go get tested and show negative. It's really only until I start developing symptoms that I need to get tested and show positive. And that's why, you know, not just for healthcare, but when we talk to everyone, the best way to defeat this virus is to not catch it in the first place. And so as I mentioned before, there are ways to mitigate your risk so that you don't need to quarantine. And at most simple, that is things like having all EMTs, paramedics wear a face mask at all times and place a face mask on all patients with suspected respiratory illness.
Thank you. The next question regarding the screening process. Why take the temperature during screening process if they have a temp and have been at work in previous days? Wouldn't they have contaminated the workplace anyway?
Dr. V?
Yeah, so yes, but again, like with everything, you know, you make your best effort. So there are people who are going to come in and either have symptoms and don't know it, have a fever and don't know it, or know it and sort of are worried enough about their life situation, like their paycheck, that they want to come in and need to be screened. And so, you know, you're not going to be able to run a test or ask questions for the asymptomatic carriers. It's just not physically possible. But that's why the questions and the temperature are sort of our best effort towards screening individuals who may be symptomatic.
Thank you. And here's the next question. It's rather long. You can also follow it along as I read it out. Given A, the incubation period before infected individuals show symptoms, B, the lag time in producing test results, and C, the fact that those tested tend to be a subset of suspected infections due to seriousness of the symptoms, the reported daily figures of confirmed cases is really a narrow snapshot of the scope of infections at some point in the past. Is there any consensus on what multiple of these officially reported numbers represent the current true number of infections?
Yeah, so that's actually a really great and insightful question, and I completely agree with you. You can't compare region to region on testing numbers alone without looking at, for example, number of individuals tested and, as a corollary to that, percentage of those tested that are deemed positive. If you have a 100% positive rate on your testing, you're probably not testing enough people. And so best available number that I have right now is five times as many. Again, that's really loose evidence and is not a great scientific basis, but that's what we've worked off of. But I think there's also other numbers you can look at. So, for example, your COVID-19 death count is one that you can compare or track. There's also your hospitalizations that you can track because the patients that are most likely to get tested are those that are being admitted to the hospital.
Thank you. And our last question in the queue, how does the response volume compare year over year?
So Chip and I can answer that. Our communities are a little bit different, but here at MedStar, we typically see a 2 to 3% growth in our overall response volume. Now, because we're in Texas and everybody wants to move to Texas, we have a dramatically increasing population that we serve. So if we were to normalize it, and we have, per capita, our call volume normally, over the last 3 years, has been trending down slightly in terms of per capita. However, in terms of real numbers, because we gain 10 to 15,000 residents a year into our community, has been going up about, 2 to 3%. Chip, how does that compare it to Richmond?
So Richmond residents love their ambulance authority. Per capita, we're one of the busiest in the country. You know, if I've got 220,000 people and then I'm running, 70,000 responses. Over the last 4 years, it's actually been going down. Our call volume has been going down. And it plateaued and stayed for about a year and a half, and then it started going down. In the past 12 months, it's gone back up, and it was some months as much as 14% over the same month a year ago. Now, this is definitely cutting into what was looking like almost a 6% increase in call volume over the course of the year. So unlike most of the places around the country, we had plateaued and started to go down. But for some reason, in the last 12 months, it's been going up.
Matt, this is Tom Wozorek. One of the things that we've seen with projects in California and then yesterday is talking to some managers in the Midwest, and we're seeing anywhere from 8 to as much as 50% drops in transports, which would be obviously generating billable revenue. So for some systems, that's going to be a significant drop in revenues on top of what is projected to be lost in sales tax revenues, as well as income tax revenues. And so it's kind of like the perfect storm where almost every revenue stream is going to be impacted at some level. And so that's why we've been working with ICMA to provide at least the assistance to communities that we can help kind of project out what staffing are you going to absolutely have to have as a basic level, and then going up from there. And so if anybody has questions, they can inquire either through ICMA or call us directly.
Yeah, and just to tag on to what Tom said, one of the things that's going to happen a longer term is the unemployment rate, which leads to the uninsured. So a fair number of the patients that we treat and transport have commercial insurance. Well, not so much anymore. When you have this high of an unemployment rate. So the payer mix is going to change. So even if the call volume recovers, the payer mix is different, so you're going to collect less for the services that you are providing. So for the folks on the call, just on the webinar, that's going to be a little bit longer term impact on your revenue generation from your EMS system. So.
And that was the last question in our queue. Presenters, do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up today's program?
Thank you.
Matt, I'll start with you.
just thank everybody for attending. I know that through Tom and CPSM, if you guys have additional questions, we are happy to help answer those on the fly or do other work. We've got a great group of folks, and the AIM High Group and Dr. Vitalani are also great resources. And I'm sure they wouldn't mind if we share some contact information. So if anybody wants to reach out to them with some specific questions, I'm sure they'd be willing to lend some help.
And with that, we must conclude today's webinar. A special thank you to our presenters and to everyone who joined us today. Please take a moment now to complete a brief evaluation of today's program by clicking the evaluation link to the left of the screen. Your comments and suggestions are important to us as we plan future events. The survey must be completed in order to receive a certificate for this program. You can also access the survey from your ICMA University dashboard by clicking on the program title once you are logged in. Thank you for your participation in today's webinar. We hope you will join us again soon. Today's program is copyright 2020 by the International City County Management Association with all rights reserved. And this does conclude today's program. Have a wonderful day. You may now disconnect.